This is Find a Way, a podcast that gives me an excuse to record important conversations with my community of friends, family, and neighbors. We may not be intergalactically famous, but we're no less inspiring or impactful on the world. Plus, I have my own selfish reasons. I know that one day when I'm old and tired of TV and the news, and hopefully wise enough to avoid scrolling myself into oblivion, I will dig up these treasured recordings, some of which I'll never share on the podcast, and I will delight myself with the beauty that I find. So, like a squirrel hoarding away nourishment for winter, I seek to chronicle the wisdom and kindness of my community so that one day I might find a way back, even if I don't feel lost. I'm Colin Whitlock of the Show and Tell Neighborhood, and this is Find a Way. Our guest this week is Dr. Maggie Clifford, songwriter, teacher, producer, writer, and musician in residence at the Arts and Medicine program at UF Shands. In addition to being a passionate and trend-bucking mother, Maggie's brilliance travels at the speed of wonderment. She is a delightful companion on any exploration of curiosity, as you'll soon find out for yourself. This conversation was recorded on St. Patrick's Day in 2025, a criminally long delay to reach you, for which I apologize. Please accept this wonderful conversation as my peace offering, with the added bonus of Maggie's original unreleased song featured at the end of the episode. Thank you for finding your way here today. Enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Right up in the face. So what's been the best podcast episode you've had so far?
Sorry,
that's a rude question to ask because of all your prior.
I think it's always the one I'm doing right now.
Because the now is all there is.
I want that to be the first thing that anybody hears from this episode.
Past, present. Now
is all there is.
The past, the future. Only happens in the now.
Yeah. Do you subscribe to that?
100%.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just turning this off. I'm very professional, by the way.
The setup has me thinking this is very professional. I'm in LA doing a LA podcast.
It is intimidating. I know that. I know.
I wouldn't call it intimidating. I would say it's disarming.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of wood.
Yeah, that's a thing for me. That's an element of myself this is like the strongest leftover of single Colin, right? This is when I live by myself, I am very I love dim lights. Mm-hmm. I believe the term is the hygge effect.
Yes. You know,
the coziness. Warm lights. I like sunlight, but when I lived by myself,
you hid from it.
I had a lot of shades up and like the dim lights on, lots of bookcases and wood. Wood is big, comfiness.
Speaking of dim lights,
yes.
The light to my left is relatively dim, but because of the angle,
right,
it's kind of in my eye.
I'm gonna move it.
Or just if it was just angled away. Yeah. Oh wow!
How about that?
Listen, magic is real.
Yeah, magic is real.
Science,
if we let it be,
also real.
Yeah, science and magic. I feel like science and magic are sort of like they're related in time. Science and magic are the same thing, but the space between them is time and discovery.
My idealized philosophical difference between magic and science would be this, and it's not a universal truth, but in some applications, I think an important difference between magic and science is that magic has an assumed quality of wanting to change something in a kind of specific way, like these ideas of spells, mm-hmm. or there's a lot of realms of magic, like animism, blah, blah, blah. But that quality, that alchemist part, the combining of things for an outcome, there's medicine is one category, which I think in that way shares a lot of similarities with like science-based medicine practice and research and all that. But the other realm of like focusing your consciousness on something and mixing things together, putting intention around a fire, something like that. That to me, while we could study it with like a science-based systematic process, that's a big difference there for me, which is like I would put it in a category of scope of practice. Like
certainly. So kind of what you're talking about sounds a little bit like, this is a shift in my perspective that I've had recently, where magic very often, not all the time, seems to be categorized by the user's desire to manipulate reality to their will, right?
And there are certainly applications in science that would share that.
Yeah.
Like wanting to increase crop yield or get to the moon.
Definitely.
That's a goal. Going to try to fit the science to get to that goal.
And I feel the shift that I've noticed within myself kind of goes along with that, which, as I get older and wiser, I hope.
Mm-hmm. At least older. We're definitely check that box.
Right. And my level of wisdom seems to be defined by my understanding of how little wisdom I have to an extent.
Samesies.
I feel like we're simpatico on that one. We both. My curiosity is boundless, and I feel like I share that with you. Mm-hmm. Even though as an aside, I feel a connection to you that makes it feel like I know you very well, but really we don't know each other. I think this is the first time we've ever sat down to just have one-on-one conversation.
It definitely is,
which is very exciting to me. Mm-hmm. But I do find that like there are certain people where I can tell right off the bat, like, yeah, we could sit and talk, which is why I asked if you wanted to do this. Okay. Back on track.
Let's call it a multifaceted intellectual resonance.
Wow. Yeah. Multifaceted intellectual resonance. So an
resonance. Yeah. Multifaceted intellectual. Yes.
We got a classic Myrrh situation.
This is Myrrhlicious.
It's miraculous.
Okay, that was better.
I mean, Merlicious. No. Don't.
No, it's fine. I'm happy to put a value judgment on that. That's fine. Myrrh. This is Myrrhtastic.
You know what? I think what I'm realizing too. Our resonance is going to, I think, has great promise in that I feel like you're going to be able to really fill in the gaps that I leave for any sort of academic...
naming of things?
Certainly, yeah. Like the categorization.
Yeah.
Validate.
Concretize, even.
Oh my, see,
I know, it's really, I've got a lot of words.
That's good.
I've been practicing.
Yes, you have
dedicated a lot of time.
Well, okay, that goes along with where I was going with my impression of magic and things like that. In the world of magic, people who practice, people who study and things like that, and this is a vast generalization here, but there are certain factions within that world that I've sort of observed from a bit of a distance.
Like what? Can you just give me an example?
My observation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just like reading and reading, watching, listening type research. Mm-hmm. Casual. I let myself dig into things that go beyond the scope of accepted science, I guess. Mm-hmm, I have allowed myself to open myself up to ridicule for my curiosities. Because
Who's been ridiculing you, Colin?
Well, I think that there's plenty of microaggressions regarding this subject, people, and I think those microaggressions are usually signs of defensiveness. Like, I need to let the people know in this room that I don't believe any of this crap, and so I'm going to make like a sarcastic comment or
it's scary to step into the unknown.
It is. Well, and actually,
it can be.
I think that's a really good way to look at it, because I think for many people, there's pressure on us to act as though we know.
And for sure.
So when we go to a place where we can't know, mm-hmm. which is this realm, which is also a realm that is, for most of our lives is represented in like Disney movies or mm-hmm. cartoons or fantasy novels or things like that. So it's heavily associated with fiction, mm-hmm. As opposed to the thousands of years of human curiosity. And there's plenty of BS, that
for
has
sure.
come out of it.
And but problematic stuff that
yeah.
harms people.
Yes. Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But still fascinating.
Always. Endlessly.
Yeah. Endlessly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I find that fascinating. And I find science fascinating, too. It's not like a...
It's a wild culture.
One versus the other.
Wild culture.
Yeah.
Wild social system.
Yeah.
Lots going on.
Is that kind of where you find yourself?
Where?
With relation to your curiosity.
I mean, I've been thinking about... something that I shared with some of my students a couple of weeks ago in this really cool class I get to teach at UF called Musical Elements of Emotion. Mm. And we were looking at kind of research methods in this one area of examining the relationships between music and emotions and well-being.
Yes.
So in going down this path of like talking about what are the methods that are actually used in this study to answer the research questions that these authors have. So then we got into a conversation eventually, because I start talking a bit about the science-based knowledge production processes. Mm-hmm. And I found myself having to go to this place of talking about the known knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. Mm. Because with undergrads especially, I want to talk with them a lot about how we don't... Science-based knowledge production is not actually about proving things. Like, that's a mathematical thing.
Yes.
And so we are just in an ever... more specific. Sometimes, science takes a lot of different paths, and sometimes it gets more specific, and sometimes we got to take a step back and then go back to an exploratory space.
Right.
But that we're in a process of disproving the null hypothesis. And which is a very beautiful, like, Buddhist approach to knowledge too, which
yes.
is the not this, not this. I think it's neti neti, not this, not that. Mm. I'm not exactly sure, but that's somewhere in my brain, so we can check that.
Sure.
Fact check.
Find a way, fact check, confirm.
Maggie is correct. Neti neti is a Sanskrit expression, which means not this, not that, or neither this nor that. It's found in the Upanishads and the Avadhuta Gita and constitutes an analytical meditation helping a person to understand the nature of Brahman by negating everything that is not Brahman. The purpose of the exercise is to negate all objects of consciousness, including thoughts and the mind, and to realize non-dual awareness. According to Wikipedia... This fact check is brought to you by Findaway on the Show and Tell Network. Thank you very much, Maggie, and back to the show.
Facts matter.
But it's like it is a cross-cultural knowledge production concept. But one thing that I was talking about with the students, having a robust theory is something that we talk about. Like, you can have a very robust theory that then falls into, especially in popular discourse, into the realm of fact, And again, it does depend on the kind of science that you're talking about. But to your earlier point, what I found myself eventually talking about with the students was how, in my experience, the more that I started to understand and know about, for example, what climate change means mm-hmm. to people in different places and contexts, the more I came to understand that, the more I realized that I did not know. And so the category of the unknown unknowns expands a bit, because
yes.
you've put yourself in so many situations where you've realized that there were there were already so many unknown unknowns, that then they become known knowns, but you're like, oh, your own personal experience shows you that, oh no, like there's going to be more and more unknowns that are going to change these other two categories, the known unknowns and the known knowns, you know?
Certainly.
Is that clear?
I mean, I think by design, it's not clear. I mean, what you're saying is clear, but the result of what you're saying is the mm-hmm. definition of unclear, right? Because those unknowns are infinite.
Yeah. No, but this relationship between like the personal experience, I'm interested in talking about how you can have this like really affecting personal experience about something. And then I don't know if this is the kind of situation that you're referencing where people are like, oh, well, that's BS, Colin. What are you talking about? If you like, is, I don't know if you would mind sharing an example of that. Like, was it like, oh, this crazy thing happened and I think it means that this thing is real or something?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I'm curious about the transition from life to death, mm-hmm. or what even death means. Yeah. Something I'm very grateful for that exists within my knowing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say it's in my mind because it might be other places too. But one of the things that I can like grok is many options for outcomes. You know, I can sit with the option that like you live, you die, curtains, that's it. Mm-hmm. Like that has a place for me. I don't feel...
I've given that place up just for the record, but right. Go on, yeah.
So that's in my least likely piles.
It's in the multiverse of possibility.
Right, you know? I just know that, like, yeah, okay, I can hear that. Like, if somebody says to me, I think we live, we die, it's over, mm-hmm. I can say, like, oh, yeah, I've thought about that. That's an interesting one. And I can... Usually, if somebody brings that sort of thing up, I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, this is a person who is, for lack of a better word, like, scientific-minded. And that is actually using science in a way that I don't necessarily agree with. But a lot of people use that word to mean, like, I'm being logical, I'm being...
I win.
Sensible. Right.
I win. It's science. You lose. Right. I'm right. You're wrong. I'm big. You're small.
Yes. That's exactly it. And
I'm familiar.
That
I'm familiar.
Is like such a... It's an abuse of that word, because science is about curiosity and just what mm-hmm. we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's about investigating those. As soon as you say, like, we've got the answer, it's over, you have ceased to be doing science.
But which is why, yeah, it's so important to talk about the like the fallacy of using the word proof, but it is important too, I think, as a knowledge production process. There are a lot of great things about it, and I know that you weren't saying that there aren't, but the saying, like, there's ample evidence to support, for example,
yes.
you know, or like in this particular population or in this particular context, but it is so critical that we include those modifiers, because it is like the absolutism is...
Well, and it's egotistical. I mean, it's inserting ego into something that is not meant to house that. You know, mm-hmm. like science is not a place for someone to create a foundation of dominance. Mm. Science is a place for us to create foundations of curiosity, investigation, mm-hmm. and to try to build, right? And you don't build by shutting doors, you know, you don't mm-hmm. build by saying, like, the first floor is done and that's all we need. Mm-hmm. You know, you keep going. And, like, if you get to the fourth floor and you realize that there's a flaw on the first floor, you stop building up and you fix mm-hmm. the problem mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. you start going, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's, like, it's worth it to continue to investigate that first floor. And then the second floor,
every time,
the third floor, you know, like...
Yeah, every time. Yeah. There are so many embedded issues across the sciences because a certain measurement or theoretical assumption or like certain assumptions that went into the building of like a big major theory kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like if you build your science on a theory that assumes that there are innate intellectual differences between people of different cultural groups,
yeah.
then your science is going to be kind of wonky.
Yep.
You're going to bring very biased, wonky questions to your science.
Yep.
In my own practice with undergrads too, in another class, is that we have found sometimes like they're interested in broadly like music and well-being, but sometimes they've come to me with these survey tools that a lot of research have been based on.
Yes.
That have been geared to like women with like body image issues. Mm-hmm. One of the effing questions on this questionnaire for to like do serious systematic science-based analysis is like, on a scale of 1 to 10, like, how sexually attractive do you feel to men, or something like that?
Wow.
I know. And it didn't, I don't think it had the men part, but it was like asking a question like that. And there were so many like very biased questions about how a woman like should, what would indicate a positive or a good body image or self-esteem, like baked into this survey tool. And that kind of issue is one that can be ameliorated through what we call diverse research teams. Because if you have someone on your team that has had body image issues, look at that and say, well, you know, and they're empowered to mention, yeah, they'll be like, I'm not sure that asking these questions is going to abide by our requirement that we do no harm here, or that we do, yeah, the least harm. Like,
yeah.
And that's across everywhere.
Of course. I mean, that's one of the most important foundational rules of research, is you're trying to make as few ripples in the pond as possible, because you're trying to measure the waves, you know,
right,
like that. So exactly right. And there, this reluctance that we have to question those things, you know, comes into play for a lot of, it seems to be, I know that there's a lot of reasons, but it seems to be that the hesitation to allow reflection like that to actually take hold and change things is generally ego-based, or at least like self-interest based. You know, well, I've already done all this work, or I've based my entire theory on this stuff.
Right.
You want me to, you know, upend that.
And for comparative purposes, it's like you keep using that crappy tool because there's already been a dozen or several dozen studies that use that tool. So then if you want to be able to build on what has, like, the good that has come from that, which is like, because maybe the intention was good, like, oh, we do want these participants and people, you know, in their demographic to heal, feel better, enjoy their lives more, da da da, but you had problematic methods and metrics to on which you based your science. So you want to be able to still be in conversation with all of that work that's been done by well-intentioned people, but you also don't want to replicate the harms and the flaws. So then that puts you in a quandary in science-based knowledge production, because then you can't do that comparative analysis. You know what I mean? Something I wanted to return to, because you started going down a topic of conversation that we mentioned, that we touched on at the show and tell a few weeks ago, decided to do this, the transitioning topic, because you and I had both listened to the telepathy tapes.
That's right.
So should we go there?
I definitely think we should go there. And that's a great example of a topic that gets a lot of rolling eyes, a lot of, like, you can't be serious, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes. I think that people could listen to that series, and at least then we could have a grounded conversation about that series. It would be interesting to go a bit more in depth with the methods that the main host, whose name I can't recall right now, went through to like examine this relationship between nonverbal people with autism and so-called telepathy, which, you know, throughout the course of the podcast, we come to have like different ways of understanding it, not even really as telepathy, but as like sort of a consciousness merging or sharing kind of thing.
Right. And maybe, I mean, that's a pretty good summary. But in general, in case people haven't listened to it, which I recommend just because it's fascinating just in theory. I happen to go a little further with it. But Yeah, the basic narrative of this podcast is a researcher discovering that there is legitimate evidence to support the idea that there is nonverbal communication happening between some people who, at a distance. Some of those people communicating are neurodiverse, nonverbal, and some of the people are either friends or family members who do not identify, who are more neurotypical. Mm-hmm. But there is communication happening, or at least the evidence seems to indicate. Many different versions of communication that is not what we would consider traditional communication methods. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
It is. The two things are coming to mind. One is that when I explained this to my dad, who I love very much and he's the best, my reflections on listening to this podcast series, his first response was, well, that would really require retooling my entire understanding of what happens when we die.
Yep.
That's what I said. I was like, yes, indeed it would.
Yep.
And I was like, but it aligns perfectly with my theory, which is the peaceful plasma theory. That's my theory of consciousness.
You can't not elaborate on that for sure.
I mean,
you can. I'm not forcing you to do anything, but I will strongly request an elaboration.
What I say for me, what feels true is that there is the consciousness that is what we call the consciousness is not material in the same way that our bodies are, but there may be one way to think about it is as a sort of material thing, but I don't, it's hard to find words for it.
Of course.
But my current working theory, and don't come at me for this, but my current working theory is that when the physical body dies, the consciousness experiences a transition to the best thing that I have come up with, and I might change the plasma part, but that it's a peaceful plasma, where there it's like non-attachment, non-judgment, maybe kind of like that Rumi poem, like out, I won't remember all of it, but out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field, I will meet you there. And that kind of feels like it sort of encapsulates an idea of what I'm thinking about with the peaceful plasma.
Out beyond the realm?
Out beyond ideas.
Oh, out beyond ideas of
wrongdoing and right doing.
There is a field. And I will meet you there.
Yes.
That's really nice.
An elder at an eco-village that my first child was born in Port Townsend, Washington, turned that into a song for singing, like, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field, I will meet you there. He's got a deep voice, though.
So. That's good. I love that.
And I have personal, I don't know which ones I feel really comfortable sharing so directly on the record, because some of them have to do with my own experience of people passing, but the thread of my own experience that tied onto the telepathy tapes, and the one that I can more easily verify because it involves other people that I'm living with, namely my children, is this experience that I've had with them not a ton of times, probably around 5 times, where there's been times in early mornings when it has been clear that my daughter, it's happened like 2 or 3 times, and my son maybe once, where they were aware of what I had been dreaming in the morning.
Wow.
Because of what, like the best example is in, it must have been like the summer of 2016, I did a filming for this film. It was really cool, like up in New York. I put on lipstick. I was with my friend Kat Wright, and we were like played music in the back of a Rolls Royce that used to belong to Elvis Presley, just to name drop Elvis Presley here.
Check.
On the air.
I can tally that one off.
Me and my buddy Elvis.
No biggie.
The spirit of Elvis was with me. So it was an unusual event. My kids were super young. I wasn't doing like things like that at that time. And it was the first night, I believe, that like my kids that went to sleep without me, both of them.
Okay.
But nearby. And So yeah, anyway, but the important part was that I was wearing lipstick and blah, blah, blah. That happened in 2016. The following summer, a year later, this thing ended. We never talked about it again, blah, 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 blah. And in fact, I think it was 2 years later. I have to get my story straight. I'll ask my daughter. She remembers everything.
Okay.
But we were sleeping in the same room. It was early morning. She got up and then she came over to lie with me in bed. And so she would have been four at this time. And I had a dream about this thing for the first time. I had never had dreamt about it since then, to my knowledge. But I was having a morning dream about recording that, filming that. And when right when I was waking up, Luana, the first thing that she said to me wasn't like, "Good morning, your mommy." She said, "Why were you wearing lipstick?" And I was like, I was like, when? Because I had just been dreaming about that filming experience. And she was like, "That time when you played music in the back of that car." And I was like, "Well, I wore lipstick because I was filming in that car with Kat, and Kat put lipstick on me." And it was so like viscerally shocking to have that happen. That was the first time that it happened. Wow. That I even was like, it was one of those moments like where you're in shock and you're trying to be chill a little bit because like you don't want to scare. I didn't want to scare her because I was feeling a little unsettled.
How did you know that?
Yes, exactly. But then there's other more mundane things too about like that I think science-based interrogation has looked more at, which is like sleeping in the same room with my children for so long, having the experience of like the sleep waves of some kind. Like when my son would go to sleep, like I could feel it. My body, I'm not looking at him like when he goes to sleep, my whole body, like it would relax. I could feel it, even though I was intentionally relaxing my body, focusing on my breathing, having my own eyes closed in the dark. So like all of these sort of the subtle forms, the energetic forms of communication and really like being in conversation with others, you know, has become more real to me just through, the intimacy of the family unit, you know.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that close proximity, extended close proximity and close vulnerability, emotional vulnerability, to remain scientific about it, I believe that there's a connection there. I don't know what it is.
But that comes up in the telepathy tapes.
Right, exactly. And that safety. Mm-hmm. Have you, just as a quick aside, have you heard of the book Original Wisdom? I'm almost positive it's called Original Wisdom.
I don't think so.
It is a nonfiction narrative of a anthropologist's experience with an indigenous tribe in Nepal.
Mm. Oh, okay.
No, I'm sorry. It's Malaysia.
Okay.
He knew that this nomadic group lived in the jungle in Malaysia and was determined to make contact with them or to find them, you know, just to witness them. Whether or not that's ethical, I don't know. But he would take these like 4-week hikes through the jungle, hoping to find them. And at some point came out into a clearing in probably his 4th or 5th journey out there, came out into this clearing and there's just this guy sitting on a rock, and he kind of stops and he communicates the best he can in like simple terms, and the guy understood him but just kind of waved him, said like, "Come on," basically said like, "Come with me." Mm. And so he follows him, and he brings them to their camp where they're staying for the next 3 months or so, and everybody's reaction to him coming is not like, "Who's this?" Mm. You know, it was more like, "Oh, okay, you're here."
Mm.
And he, you know, slowly, he got to stay with them for like a week this time, and he had multiple visits with them. They told him like where to find him and things like that. But in this first visit, his big discovery was that their routine in this group was, you know, everybody sleeps in the same room together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and they all sleep in the same room, and they're all touching. Somebody's always touching somebody else to somebody else to somebody else. In the mornings, they'd wake up, build a fire, sit around the fire, and have some silence until somebody would stand up and say, "I saw a white bird in a tree. Mm. And he realized, of course, this person's talking about a dream. And then, you know, five or six other people would say, yes, I saw the white bird. Yes, I saw the white bird. Mm. And then somebody would say, and the tree had purple flowers. Mm. Oh, yes, the purple flower. And then more and more people and more. And by the end of the whole session, they would have together built this scene. Like, yes, there's a tree with purple flowers, and there's a bird, and there's this, and there's that, and there's a big boulder, and there's this. And then they'd get done. They'd say, okay, let's go. And the guy would be like, well, what are we doing? And they'd look at him and be like, we're looking for the bird in the tree with the purple flowers, and that's what we're doing today. And so they'd go, and they'd search and search and search and, like, hunt along the way and do their things, and then they'd find it. And below this tree would be this flower that only blooms once a year or once 10 years or something like that, and it's blooming today. And they say, oh, that's why we're here today. Okay, and so they all sit and watch the flower. And when they're coming back from this, the guy goes to the person who welcomed him first in this clearing, feeling as though he'd kind of figured something out. And he said, like, so when I showed up, did you know that I was going to be? Did you dream that I was going to be here? Mm-hmm. And he said, "No, I didn't dream that you were going to be here. It's just
I can smell you a mile away."
that's probably. He said, "No, everybody else, you know, their dream. They dreamt of going to find a tree with a bird and blah blah blah. But that day, I dreamt of that rock that I was sitting on. Mm-hmm. And so they all went. And I said, "Well, I got to go to the rock." So I went to the rock, and I sat. And then you showed up, and I thought, oh, that's why I'm here. Mm-hmm. Come on, you better come with me. Mm-hmm. And so, like, this whole group, their whole mode of life is shared dreams and just going with it, you know, just kind of, and it, I mean, that's just one. There's, like, some really incredible, stories from that experience. I think it plays right into what we're talking
about.
For
sure.
Here.
And I appreciate you raising that cultural context and that beautiful story, because it does empower me to, like, it doesn't feel like a confession, but it is so countercultural.
Yes.
That I still sleep in the same room with both of my children.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I have a king-sized bed, and I sleep with my 11-year-old daughter, and then I have a single bed right next to it, and my 13-year-old son sleeps there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we have three bedrooms in our house, but, like, it's just never... I've never, ever felt this requirement, or it never felt right to me to impose a separate sleeping arrangement, which is... Yeah, as I mean, countercultural is the only way for me to really describe
certainly
it
is, yeah.
Here. I mean, a part of that comes from my childhood experience with my dad, that I got so much safety and security from the fact that if I couldn't go to sleep, I could go ask and he would come lie down with me until I would go back to sleep. Until forever. It was never not an option.
Yeah.
And having had that wonderful experience, and I feel like I've reaped so many benefits from that level of security and assuredness from an adult person in my life, it was just always super obvious to me that, like, oh, I'm always going to offer that. And, you know, there have been times where I had to... It's not like sometimes I had to force myself to open my arms, but like metaphorically, but also materially.
Sure.
But it was an expansion to commit myself to making that our family arrangement for, you know, it's been 13 years, you know, and having lived it for all these years, I feel like I would be missing so much if it weren't for the minutes and sometimes an hour or so before bed. Like, I can't imagine just, like, reading a story and leaving. And this is no judgment to the people who do that. Almost, you know, clearly it's the countercultural thing. And I think adults need to prioritize their sleep. Maybe because of my childhood experiences, I was like, oh, I can make this work for me, you know?
Sure.
But, yeah, anyway, sometimes it does get construed as sort of like, well, this is the better way to do something, but
certainly.
And
well,
I'm sensitive to that.
I think as a parent, one of the hardest, I mean, God, there's a long list of of challenges, but one of the hardest ones is doing what feels like the right thing to do despite cultural norms or judgments. And I think actually that kind of, I forgot that we were starting to go in a different direction a little while ago, but it dovetails into this nicely with sort of my shifting view of what in like when it comes to magic. You know, there's people who feel there's like the left-hand way, the right-hand way. There's the like good magic, bad magic, whatever magic, mm-hmm. you know.
Good science, bad science.
Yeah, good science, bad science. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of, I mean, everybody's got different ideas of what good is and bad and everything like that. But for me, I feel as though a definition is growing in me where I am beginning to define what I think of as good or at least compassionate, positive magic, whatever you want to call it, not as being something where I want to manipulate reality, but more, can I expand my awareness and my empathy and my consciousness to the point that I can understand why things must go the way they do? And so
it's interesting, must go
or
why
I mean,
they do go.
Yeah, the way it does. I guess I have a feeling maybe you are experienced with the what some people call like the flow state, mm-hmm. you know, when mm-hmm. you just when I feel just tapped into like, wow, yes, this and then this mm-hmm. and this is happening. This is mm-hmm. great. And it's not always good. You know, there are parts of good luck, bad luck, whatever, that flow of like good thing happens, bad thing happens and things even out kind of thing. But if I just go with what feels right and what I can feel in my chest and my head and my body in general and whatever exists beyond it, if that buzzes with what I'm doing, then that's how I know I'm doing that right thing. Just like mm-hmm. you choosing to have this dynamic in your household with your kids and within your family, it just feels right. You know that there are others who don't vibrate with that, who mm-hmm. don't like, you know, might judge it.
He knows to have his own room.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
which he could. Why?
Just right.
Yeah. I wouldn't be able to scratch his back until I go to sleep, and he goes
exactly.
to sleep. You know, like
exactly.
how delightful is that?
Right. Like, and that's just you tapping into like you went with that. You know, and maybe it was easier for you to go with it than others.
Yeah, well, I was prioritizing all of our sleep. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and therefore, like, that's the magic of it. It's mm-hmm. like having the power to do that thing, mm-hmm. even when there's resistance to it, mm-hmm. That doesn't involve, you know, the people directly affected by it, but, you know, others looking in from the outside. I think that is magic to me, you know, feeling like I can push against a flow that just doesn't work for me, you mm-hmm. know, or doesn't feel right.
Right.
And that I can go with the flow even when it's like, even when it's uncomfortable. And I'm thinking like this, you know, this is going to hurt. You know,
this is going to hurt.
Right. You know,
this is hurting.
Yeah. Or like, gosh, you know, I really wanted to read a comic book today, but I had a dream about a bird and a tree and a rock and I guess I gotta go check that out, you know, and then being able to see, oh wow, look, this flower's blooming.
What's so interesting is to think about the what we could view that narrative, assuming that he's got it right, that the whatever the anthropologist or whatever his background is that was
right.
relaying this information, assuming that our understanding of that situation is more or less correct, because you never know.
No.
You never know, but obviously, but with that assumption in mind, it would be interesting to view it through a science-based knowledge production lens, because it's even though to a person for whom that sort of process is completely wackadoodle dandy,
mm-hmm.
You could also view it through this like, oh, trial, error, like result. Mm-hmm. They've had enough experiences as mm-hmm. a group
yes.
that if they go through this process, that they're going to find something cool AF.
Right.
They're like, oh yeah, they have gone through their own process of elimination to say it works enough times for us to trust that I need to go sit on this rock and y'all need to go find that flower because something mad cool is happening.
Yes.
And we all know it, you know, for the same reason that we'll, any choice that we make to go to school, my kids are questioning that all the time now,
yep.
actually,
yep.
reasonably, like legitimately. My daughter's like, who invented school? Why am I going there for 6 hours a day? It's a really good question. and there
yep.
isn't an easy answer for it, you know, and I don't really feel like going down that path of talking about that, those conversations, but we have reason to believe that there are some good outcomes that can come in a certain number of cases
yep.
for people to do this, you know.
That's a conversation I have with almost every student that I work with.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
That I... their families.
Do you still work with students now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you do?
I'm a private tutor now.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I've got like 6 or 7 students that I see on a regular basis and work with their families. And that's always a conversation that I have with parents or, you know, guardians, caregivers it's always a difficult one, or at least I'm asking a lot of them.
Mm.
But I remind them that, okay, let's just reset for a moment. Let's pretend like we are inventing school right now.
Yes.
Let's pretend we're inventing our priorities and not having them given to us.
Mm-hmm.
Does it really matter that your child has a D in sixth grade science right now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, it matters for their confidence right now. It matters for their ability to get into this class or that class and things like that. Okay, great. Does it matter in the big scheme of things? Does it matter in comparison to their emotional well-being? Are there things that matter more than the science class today? You know, is your kid struggling with something that maybe goes beyond the classroom
mm-hmm.
and perhaps is even something getting in their way of being able to concentrate in the classroom? Is it worth it for us to concentrate on that thing instead of doing an hour of intense
mm-hmm.
science studying today and making sure they know that if they get an F on this next test, then they're grounded for a week
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that kind of
mm-hmm.
thing. It's a hard thing to break people of that thought process because this school system that has been invented for us seems to really emphasize its own importance left and right. If they don't do well in that sixth grade class,
no.
then they can't get into the honors program. And if they can't get into honors, they can't get the recommendations. They won't go to college. They'll never get a job.
The stakes.
Yes.
The stakes. The imaginary stakes.
Yes.
They're so high.
I need to incorporate that term into my vocabulary more is imaginary stakes.
Imaginary yeah. stakes.
And I tell that to my kids. I mean, and I tell the parents that, you know, I'm going to be using this terminology with them. But I do tell them, like, this is all made up.
Mm-hmm.
These grades, these standards, things like that. I had one of my students were working on reading because they didn't get the reading instruction the same way most kids do in the time that they did. And so this student is in eighth grade, but they read at a third grade reading level,
mm-hmm.
or at least that's what they said to me. I read at a third grade reading level. And I said, like, wait a minute. What grade are you in? Eighth grade. Okay. Do you read? Yes. Eighth grade reading level.
Bada bing, bada boom.
You are an eighth grader and
mm-hmm.
you read at that level. Who cares? Right? Like,
mm-mm.
what, you know, whether you can do the same math as the kid sitting next to you in the same year, like, that is not, that's important for somebody else's organization.
Mm-hmm.
The administrators, the school system in general, needs to be able to say, they have passed what I have designated as.
Yeah.
The eighth grade reading level
mm-hmm.
so that I can stamp this thing. It
mm-hmm.
is not for the benefit of the student.
Mm-mm.
What good does it do the student to be
Mm-mm.
told you're reading at a third grade reading level and
mm-hmm.
you're in eighth grade? It doesn't do anything except mm-hmm. to shame them.
And arguably, the inverse is equally problematic. That, oh, you're performing in the top 98th percentile.
Yes. Right.
Like, that's also not cool.
Right.
Like,
You're better than 98%.
You're smarter. Yeah. You're better. Yeah. You are. This is promising. This shows that you are. Wow. You're just going to keep on winning. Based on these test scores, you're a winner. You're going to keep winning in whatever systems proliferate around you.
I was told at a young age what my IQ was.
Oh, dear God.
In comparison to, you know, when I got into the gifted program. Uh-huh. No, not to my sister, but she probably would beat me.
Physically or
that too? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, but she was gentle.
Smart,
with me, considering.
Smart lady.
But yeah, I remember being told and having it be emphasized, you know, like, look at you in comparison to this. Mm-hmm. And then growing up with this like intense imposter syndrome.
Totally.
Because like,
you don't know anything.
Right.
You're a child.
Yeah.
You might have an aptitude for something, but you don't know anything. But you're like, oh, but I'm supposed to know stuff based on this stuff.
Not to mention that like so much of my behavior was thrown back at me as inappropriate behavior. You know, I'm...
Because you're a funny guy.
Yeah. Because I'm like, you know, easily distracted, very curious, very when I would like to ask questions that teachers very often took as like me being, you know, giving attitude or something. Mm-hmm. And really me just being like, no, I'm curious about this.
This is a legitimate question that I have. Mm-hmm.
And just thinking like, well, wait a minute. I thought I was smart. I thought, you know, mm-hmm. and it doesn't, it doesn't mean anything. the IQ thing,
the IQ thing especially.
Especially.
I'm tired of it. I'm tired of that. I'm tired of the test scores.
Yeah.
I'm tired of it. It's
Me
like,
too.
This is not it.
It's one of the reasons why I quit the public school system. It's just like...
It's torturous.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah, and I have kids that do well on the tests, and it still makes me nauseous. It makes me like, I'm just like, yuck. And the pressure that they embrace, it's, again, for some reason, especially my daughter, it's like, it's cuckoo. Until this year, they were going to this small Montessori school with a great, you know, head teacher. And so it was like, you don't talk about it. They had to do some testing for like state reporting and stuff, but we don't talk about it. I never told them anything. I had access to it because I had to when I applied for the magnet programs, blah, blah, blah. But now in the public schools, it's like they give those test scores to the children to bring home.
Yep.
And everything is graded.
And they share it. I mean, the kids look at each other's
grades.
Oh,
my gosh.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I... I know it's a baffling approach to early childhood development. But I'm glad that we're having it, to be honest, because otherwise you don't know. Well, you don't know what you don't know. You know what I mean?
Sure. I do know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think, again, it's a system which is self-perpetuating for its own good. And the things they emphasize don't really line up with, you know, what we know to be the qualities of a thriving society. You know, they don't...
Mm-hmm. You know, it's occurring to me right now that one of the things... Sometimes I forget to tell the undergrads this. But because, you know, UF in the past few years became... school where that it admits an ever shrinking percentage of the applicants.
Yes.
So we're getting the really high achieving students and the stress they are feeling. But I'm so pleased to be able to inform them that the highest grade they can get is a 94. Like, because it's after that, it's A's. There's no A plus. I can't give you an A plus. I had realized that I had forgotten to tell this to one course I'm teaching is an honors section this semester. And I realized that I had forgotten to tell them that because, like, you know, the grades at another, even at above 94, they're trying to jockey to get 100 or higher or something like that. Well, because that was what they were indoctrinated to try to do so that they could get above a 4.0 or whatever to get into the school they wanted to blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, wait, guys, have I told you yet that In fact, the highest grade that you can get is a 94, because it was always, I was like, why are they freaking out? Literally, like, for you to get below a 90 in my class, like, because I don't really prioritize that sort of competitive edge of like, oh, I'm going to give you a wide range of grades. I'm just like, you have to turn in quality stuff and I have to see that you are putting in effort, but I'm not trying to have a widespread of grades. And the students, because they're also high achieving, they all are doing great. I do give some B's and I have failed one student once over the past 2.5 years. The point is, that's a different story. But the point is, like, when I told them, like, the look on their faces, when I was like, you do know that the highest grade you can get is a 94. And if you get a 93.5 or above, I will round that right up to a 94. It's going to be great. Then you'll have an A. That's the highest grade you can get. They were like, wait, what? And I was like, I hope, because I try to infuse as much de-escalating, de-stress into the learning environment because I can, because that course specifically is a Quest course, like it's open to all majors. And so many of them are taking these really super apparently high stakes classes where you have to do all the memorization of a ton of different chemical compounds and interactions and material objects and blah blah blah, and like, yeah, but this does this and this is called this and da 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 da, and like are taking these multiple choice examinations that I'm just like, I don't envy you. But then again, that's why I didn't go into microbiology. But thank you for doing that, because one day you'll be a doctor. See you at the hospital.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's like, it's wild.
Yeah.
It's a wild world out there.
It really is. And I think we are like kids with mentalities like that. I want to relieve them of it, not just in the way of like, oh, you're feeling pressure that I don't want you to feel. Mm. But I also want to relieve them of it from the standpoint of like, this is, irrational. Like you're,
but it is, but it's reasonable given the context that they're in.
Right.
Yes. Right. Right.
They've been, yes. That's what I mean to imply is that, mm-hmm. that they have been, infected mm-hmm. with this irrational
injected.
Yes.
Infected.
Yeah. You know,
infatuated.
They just, and I have students like who are on that track, you know, mm-hmm. who really are intense about it. And I don't try, you know, I don't try to completely douse it in them. If that's, you know, if what they're adding up to equal happiness is like being the best of the best of the best, mm-hmm. I'm here to try to help. Mm-hmm. But I see it as somebody who, I see that quality as mm-hmm. something that is, it's an irritant, mm. or it's something that is getting in the way of mm-hmm. of a, like the what they have misidentified perhaps what their true goal is, you know, mm-hmm. and I want people to be able to make their own goals, but I think if your own internal happiness and well-being is not part of the equation, then you've missed it.
What the F are we doing?
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really try to get that across. It's just like, that's fine. If you think being a doctor and getting straight A's in all your classes and all that thing, if that is really going to light you up, that's great. Just show me. Like, where's your happiness related to this?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. But then that's, to go down that path, we yeah. get into the pressures of the systems that we're in and our intimate circles.
Of course.
The pressures of the family.
Which is where we were at, actually. You've put a lot of your focus on that. Mm. And the reward you seem to, or at least like some sort of experience that you seem to be getting in response, is what some might categorize as supernatural experiences. These like intense...
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Magical, you could say.
Magical, if you will. In this theory that we're building, or maybe we've mm-hmm. been independently building, but seemingly...
Thinking together.
Yeah,
thinking with.
Our friends Katie and Mike taught me this concept of running toward the danger.
Mm. Is yeah. this Opus Katie and Mike or no? Different Katie
no,
and Mike. So many Katie and Mikes out there.
Lots of Katie and Mikes. Mm-hmm. None quite like My Katie and Mike, of or course. Opus Katie and Mike.
Oh, yeah, I don't even. Now I'm like, wait, is his name Mike? I don't know. Go on.
Katie Levy and Mike McVicker.
Okay.
Of Gander up in New York. I'm always just amazed by them because they're so courageous. They really go after big things, and they. You know, they went to New York City and built a design studio, and they thrive, you know, and just the idea, the gall to go to New York City and say, like, I'm going to start a design firm and, you know, kick some ass. But still, it's not easy to run toward the danger, but it's easier when it's for something important, something that means something. And so running toward the danger can even mean like, yeah, like I feel like the right thing for me and my family is for us to sleep in the same room together and like buck this social norm for the sake of having this intimacy with each other and this vulnerability with each other. Those sorts of actions, I believe there is some form of, for lack of a better word, like reward, you know, some sort of like something the universe gives back. Yes, you did that thing, and now here's what you experienced as a result, you know, shared dreams or whatever other sorts of things that go into it. In my own experience, you know, I've had some weirdnesses that make me believe in an afterlife or make me believe that there is something beyond our bodies that exists so that I can
so
say...
So let's get into those. Come on.
Well, I mean, you know.
Before we move on, though, I do want to, in the spirit of thinking together, it's not bristling, but I am thinking about the word danger there, because I guess in my experience, it has not felt like running toward danger, but I mean, risk might work.
Sure.
But I guess in my experience, and I'm experiencing it in some levels now and something's going on in my life, but running toward or briskly walking toward, like, I don't know, it's even hard to call it like a feeling, because it's a direction and a flow. It's not quite as catchy as running toward danger, but I think maybe it's the mother in me. I wouldn't run toward something that I felt was, you know, in the spectrum of risk on the side that's too far into the danger. Like, there have to be the pathways that I can imagine in that space, there has to be at least a high percentage of, no, that's gonna, no, if it goes that way, it's okay. If it goes that way, it's okay. It's
certainly
okay. You know?
Yeah. I think that, I don't think it means like, you know, if there's a volcano erupting, I don't think it means jumping in. You know, I think, I think
I like that one. Yeah. That was good. I don't think it means jumping in.
Right. You know, I think risk is a great word for it. I think if there is something that
risk, maybe in the way there's good stress, running toward the good risk.
Yeah, and there is good stress. Good. You're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, good stress is a very important thing to know about. And I think you know, like for me, when the pandemic hit, I chose to start tutoring. After quitting public school, after some time in the pandemic, like not having a 9-to-5 and not going all the time, it hit me like, oh, this is good for me. You know, there's a lot of things that aren't good for me about this situation, but one thing I know is good is having a little bit of time in the morning, you know, and exercising every day, making that a priority, and something, you know, eating right, all those things.
Mr. Health Nut over here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody, that's what everybody calls me, the old health nut. Health Nut Whitlock.
Well, I've heard it said.
That's, I mean.
Right here.
We're on the street. It started here.
This street.
But when it came time to like, okay, everybody, it's time to go back to work. It's time to get some work going. For me, running toward the danger was telling my partner, actually, I'm going to really try to do something where I'm in charge of my schedule.
Yes.
And it might mean not making as much money at first, but
yeah.
You know,
I see. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's dangerous. And I still feel danger in that. You know, there've been like ebb and flow with my success in this, and it would be a lot easier to just, I could go back to a school pretty much any day if I wanted, or I could, you know, there's other jobs I could do.
Is it too problematic to call it the good danger? I think it's, yeah, because good and bad, yeah, I mean, we've already, you touched on a little bit the thing. That,
what about
like,
worthy danger?
Worthiness, too, has the issues. Yeah,
valuable danger. Or?
The right danger. The right danger. The
And that's the thing about
this. The resonant danger.
Resonant RD.
RD. It's R&D that I can talk about.
I think if it feels like danger that you're... Mm-hmm. If there's maybe it's opportunistic danger. I don't know. That doesn't sound good either. But there's something about the faith in I'm going toward this danger because
yes,
it feels like it's going to bring me to this other place.
I need to ask you something.
Go on.
What is your background in public, whatever means by public, in front of others, your music performance background?
Is this
related? This is directly related to running toward danger.
So, as in, like, playing something that I've practiced a bunch and know the ins and
outs, childhood
to
now. To,
oh, okay.
Like, and even in solo stuff.
Right. Okay. So performance, let me see. I think the first time I ever performed as a solo, I did like school performances, mm-hmm. chorus and
okay.
things like that. Band.
Group school performances, yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
did band. And then playing my own stuff or like just playing a guitar in front of people. The first thing I did was probably when I was like 14 or 15, I played
yes.
at a Friendly's.
Indeed you did.
With a guitar, like an electric guitar and an amp.
How many songs did you play? In a booth?
In a booth.
How did you set that up? You were like, you went, did you just...
Yeah, I put the amp on the table.
Did you tell Friendlies? Did you like...
Yeah, we set this up. It was like some sort of... I don't...
Where did you grow up? Where was this?
This is in Indian Atlantic, Florida, which is near Melbourne,
okay.
Florida.
Okay. Near what?
Melbourne, Florida.
Okay.
And I played there. And I also played at... There was a coffee shop that I worked at called Murray's Coffee to a Tea.
Of course.
And I... My friend Greg, he would play there and he made me think that I could do it. Oh, yeah. That was the first time I ever played by myself. But I played in a band. My first band was in 6th, 7th grade. In 8th grade, we were called Regicide. Yeah.
That sounds serious. Like, ooh. Killing of Kings?
Yeah, the Killing
okay.
of Royalty, yeah. Actually, but our name before that was...
Homicide.
This is maybe the worst band name.
Wait, can I guess?
You can
Wait,
try.
The worst band name that you've ever heard?
That, I mean, I've never, this is not another band's name for good reason. We
Dingleberries.
Came up with this. Nope.
That
That's
would be
great
a good
one.
I
that
know.
Would have been,
I'm
yeah,
sorry, I can't
on.
Think of a bad one.
I know.
Okay, so what is it?
Oh, God.
This
it is called Juvenile Justice.
Oh, snap. Oh, justice has been served. Wow. Oh, my God.
Juvenile justice.
Justice, wow.
It's the worst.
Wow. School of Hard Knocks.
Sure
just
was.
A bunch of kids who
yeah.
got their licks on these streets and
totally.
Came together for juvenile justice.
Nobody knew
band.
What they were in for. Yeah.
Dang.
So yeah, that's when it started. 6th grade, I guess. I was playing drums in that band. But
okay, so clearly I have this theory.
Okay, go on.
Around in my own personal experience with solo performing.
All right, folks. This marks the end of part one of my conversation with Dr. Maggie Clifford. And let me tell you, I did you a solid on this one, okay? I was this close. And let me tell you, my index finger and thumb are very close together. I was this close to making the cliffhanger of part one be the name of my middle school band was Cut. And then you're going to have to go to the next episode to find out. I know. It was ill-conceived, cruel even. All right? I didn't do it. I gave it a second thought. I realized what I was doing was wrong, so I didn't do it. I gave you the answer. I knew you were at the edge of your seat. How would you live with yourself not going to the next episode? But I didn't want to force you to do it, okay? It felt dirty. It felt wrong to make you just go over because you wanted to get this answer. I wanted to give it to you freely. So I did, okay? And I think I left you with another great cliffhanger because Maggie is just about to tell us one of her fascinating theories about performance and her experiences as a solo artist. As you can tell, Maggie's brilliant, and Maggie has a treasure trove of brilliance just waiting for us. All we have to do is ask nicely. That's what I did, and she shared with great generosity. I'm so grateful for it, and I'm even more grateful that I get to share it with you. So please, we're going to go on to the next episode. We have another great discussion We talk about the theory that I just mentioned. We talk about the experience of performance-related anxiety when responded to with applause and praise, sort of like a mixed bag experience as a performer. We talk about the struggle of artists to sort of reconcile with their past selves and the art that we make in the past, and whether it means the same thing to us as it does to the beholder, the viewer, the listener. We talk about our spirituality as well. We talk about a couple of spiritual experiences that we have, some experiences that are hard to explain, or at least hard to explain to others so that it sounds real, which is, you know, some of my favorite stuff. And bonus, at the end of part two of this episode, you will hear Maggie's unreleased single, I Can Pretend, which I can tell you right now is absolutely gorgeous. I'm in love with it. I've listened to it 3 times today already. You're going to love it. You can't find it anywhere else. You can find Maggie in tons of places. You can find Maggie on the streaming platforms. You can find Maggie at Arts and Medicine at UF Shands. You can find Maggie at her website, maggieclifford.com. You can find her on Instagram. You can find her all over the place. I'm going to list all these links where you can find her. If you're really smart, you'll go and see her perform live. It's an experience worth having, and you will walk away grateful that you did it. So without any further ado, I encourage you to hop on over to part two of my conversation with Maggie. It's already there waiting for you. And I thank you again for sticking around, for listening to Find a Way, for being kind to yourself, to your neighbors, to your community, to strangers on the street, and to the people you love. Thanks very much.